Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In his book, How to Change History, writer Robin Hemley grapples with the individual's navigation of history and the conflict between personal and public histories. In an attempt to restore, resurrect, and reclaim what might otherwise be lost, Hemley meditates and speculates on photography, scrapbooks, historical markers, travelogues, TV shows, real estate come-ons, washed-up rock stars, incontinent dachshunds, and stalkers and skeletons in the closet, and literature. He also examines his parents' lives as writers, documented undersea influence on art movements of the day. This book is about reconstruction. Hemley says that while we cannot change events once they have passed, we can return to those events and learn to sometimes perhaps change our understanding of them. Robin Hemley joins us following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In his book, How to Change History, writer Robin Hemley grapples with the individual's navigation of history, the conflict between personal and public histories. In an attempt to restore, resurrect, and reclaim what otherwise might be lost, he meditates and speculates on photography, scrapbooks, historical markers, travelogues, TV shows, and many other details. He also examines his parents' lives as writers, documenting their underseen influence on the movements of the day. In this book about Reconstruction, he says that while we cannot change events once they have passed, we can return to those events to learn and sometimes perhaps change our understanding of them. Robin Hemley is the author of 16 books, including Oblivion, an after-autobiography, The Art and Craft of Asian Stories, and Borderline Citizen, Dispatches from the Outskirts of Nationhood. An innovator of the contemporary essay, Hemley's won numerous fellowships, residencies, and awards, pushcart prizes. He's the founder of the International Nonfiction Conference, Nonfiction Now. Robin Hemley, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for inviting me.
So you're speaking to me from New York, I think?
Yes, New York City.
But you're with the University of Iowa, I think.
Well, I'm a professor emeritus at the University of Iowa, and I'm also a professor at Long Island University in Brooklyn.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's why you're in New York, I guess, at this point.
Yeah.
But you were telling me before we went on the air, you did teach at University of Utah.
Yeah, I taught for 3 years. I loved it. I taught there in the early 2000s, a professor of English and creative writing. And the only reason I left was because I was offered a position to direct the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. And it was an offer that was too good to pass up, but I loved my time in Utah.
So some of the themes in the book, you're interested in remembering, right, and memorials, also the way memory gets erased, right?
Yeah.
The subtitle of this collection, How to Change History, is a salvage project. I guess that's a big theme here.
Yeah, but because I'm really interested in the ways in which we, you know, there are certain things we remember differently from other people, certain things that we don't remember that other people do, and certain events in history even that get sort of erased. And I'm really interested in the ways in which we consider our own personal histories and the ways in which those intersect with larger histories. You know, so for instance, I have an essay about an older relative of mine who was a survivor of Pearl Harbor and led a rather tragic life. And I had his whole story wrong. And I only got the story right, or at least as close as I could, when I met, after many, many years, or re-met his daughter. And she told me the real story. So those types of things for me are real nuggets, you know, things that I think about again and again. You know, just one more example of how, for instance, I come across a recording, let's say I come across a recording of my now 17-year-old daughter from when she was 7 years old, and she's talking about a drawing of hers of a spider, and I have no memory of that, And it's almost as though I'm a different person, she's a different person, and how do I sort of incorporate all of that that difference into, and sort of who she was and now is into my, current thinking about her.
You begin the book in your prologue talking about an experience. You were on an airplane. You glanced over and somebody was watching the film Wall Street. And you focused on Daryl Hannah's hair from when was this? The 80s, I think, this
Well,
film.
the film was Wall Street. It was from the 80s,
And it's the hair that really strikes you in juxtaposition, I guess, with thinking about Daryl Hannah now, right? Much older.
So it was just one of those things where, when I was a young man in my 20s, Daryl Hannah was pretty much at the height of her career, and she was considered, this star and great beauty and so on. And I also, she and I and everyone else at the time dressed according to the fashion standards of the day, including our hair, what we wore, and so on. And so when I looked over in that other person's seat and saw them watching this film from the 1980s, where her hair was this enormously big hair and seemed so out of date, it gave me a little shock. And I was thinking not only about her and, how she obviously would have changed between that time, but also how I've changed and how I thought certain styles were normal and that I would now laugh at, things that I dressed in, or the way I wore my hair, I would be too embarrassed to show anyone now. I would never think of it. And so I was really interested in how things that we think are normal at one time in our lives become completely abnormal and even sometimes laughable
So
as we
you
age.
talk about you're interested in this switch, right? That things are au courant, right? Right up until they aren't. That switch.
Yeah, we sort of it's sort of toggling back and forth, really, because in the 70s I wore, bell bottoms or whatever, and really things that now I would never be caught in, and then at some point, maybe in the late 80s or mid 80s, all of a sudden wearing something like that was considered, not something that anyone would want to wear. And then recently, maybe a year or two ago, I was mentioning to one of my daughters how, I would never wear those fashions. And she said, "Oh no, they're back in now. Everyone wears them and they're great, And I'm really curious about what sort of makes something seem laughable one minute, and then the next, it seems it's just you would never even consider wearing it or saying it or doing it. That goes for, slang too, and things that phrases that people say, and what I might have said when I was a kid, like to express something as being exciting, is I would say it was neat, And who says neat these days? It really dates me.
Right. I want to read a passage here from the prologue. This is Robin Hemley writing in his book, How to Change History. You write, "Am I the only one? I don't think so. Who, when watching The Wizard of Oz or listening to Annette Henshaw, think stupidly, I know, what are they doing here? They're dead. That's not them, but it is." I think we've all had that. That kind of that moment, right? Where that moment is preserved, right? You look at The Wizard of Oz and those actors are all dead, but they're still here, but it's not them.
Exactly. And that's also kind of what I was trying to say with talking about my daughter and like this little film clip I have of her from when she was seven. That's her and it isn't her, but she's moved past that. We've moved past that. And the same with stars. You look at someone like Judy Garland, as I do in that chapter or in that prologue, and you think you watch whatever it is, The Wizard of Oz or any of her films, and you can't watch it, say, innocently. You can't watch it without thinking about the rest of her life and how tragic it was. And so it in some ways informs you, informs the way you look at the film. In some ways, maybe it taints it a bit, in that, at least for me, when I look at someone like that whose life went on way beyond that film and had this really, in some ways, a kind of downward spiral emotionally and physically, that comes into play as I'm viewing it. And I find that really poignant.
By the way, you have a just a kind of a side, you're looking back, you dismiss nostalgia. That's where we could go, right?
Right.
And I guess maybe you're saying that's where you could go with
Right.
these essays, but you're not into nostalgia.
Well, as I think I say in there, it can't be kicked out of the room completely. You're going to be nostalgic about certain things, and that's fine. But to write a bunch of essays that are all weepy about the past would get tedious pretty quickly. And also, it's kind of self-indulgent too. Like the fact that I feel nostalgic about something doesn't necessarily mean that you will. And I think it's my job as a writer to engage you in a way that's not just about me, but about sort of larger things that affect you too. So we all feel nostalgia, it's normal. But I think, a little goes a long way. And I think that it's important to have emotion and to be emotional, but not overly sentimental. And nostalgia, I think, works in a way that it just naturally can make you so sentimental that people will, some people will have a negative reaction to that, I think.
It can be a haze, right? You're not seeing clearly, right?
Well, yeah, it's like the whole thing, the good old days kind of thing. Life was simpler, good old days and all that. You block out a lot of stuff that maybe doesn't conform to that idea. And so as a writer, I feel it's my job to look at things as honestly as possible and as incisively as possible, and not to sort of play tricks on myself or with the reader.
I want to move to an essay you wrote about your mother. She's at this point in this essay, she's elderly, living in Seattle, I think,
Yeah, in Bellingham,
in
Washington.
Bellingham. Yeah, gets to a point where you all decide she can't live alone anymore. But as this most often happens, she's fighting for the last shred of independence.
Yeah.
And that's a tough decision, for everyone involved. You write about conversations with the landlady. Usual things, right? Deposit everything as you're moving your mother out. But also this L. Your mother has painted an L on the wall. Tell me about that.
Yeah. We had these. It took me a long time to convince her to move to an assisted living place. And as you say, she was resistant, and I felt a lot of sympathy for her, but she really had to move for her own safety, and she couldn't live with us for various reasons, that also had to do with safety and small children and things like that. I eventually convinced her to move, and I asked her to, put the things in boxes that she wanted to keep. And she did this. And at one point, I discovered this. I went to her to her apartment, and she had written an L on the wall, and the landlady was really curious about this. She was actually very good natured, but she said, "You know, I want to hear the story of the L. I'm sure that it's a really interesting one." And I finally understood. I mean, I didn't know what she had done, why she had painted the L, but I finally understood that it was. I can't remember exactly, but I believe it was the name of the place that she was moving to, and it meant the one it was the to designate the boxes that would be moved there, that she would bring with her rather than be put in storage. And I found it really poignant because she had mistaken the wall for one of these boxes, and I saw it, and I thought, well, yeah, she wants to bring this apartment with her. She wants to bring her independence with her. She wants to bring all of that you can't possibly move. And so I immediately saw it as this really, sort of heartbreaking thing that she wasn't quite aware of, but it made me aware of just how difficult this was for her. I mean, I was aware of it before, but this was in a real visceral way when I saw that L.
There's a scene that really struck me. I guess you're driving or whatever, and she reminds you we need to get that new computer. And her eyesight's failing, right? And I don't know if you say it or think it, but you're thinking, well, we need to see if you can actually see the screen. If not, we're not going to buy the computer, right?
Well, she was a writer, and her whole identity was really fashioned around being a writer, and she loved art and writing, and she wrote every day, and she suffered from macular degeneration and glaucoma, and these were really challenging for her, and she just was unable to see the screen for unless you had the letters sort of giant size, and also her fac mental faculties were declining, and so she really had trouble writing anything that was coherent. I thought when she said this, and I thought, I admit it was ungenerous at the time, but I was sort of under a lot of stress. How can we get you a computer when you can't even see the screen? I didn't say that to her. And I believe we did eventually get the computer for her because, like the L, it meant a lot more than just the ability to, use it. It meant something about her independence, and so yeah, I think we got it for her, and she did the best she could with it, but it meant a lot to her.
This chapter, you take us back, you introduce us to your mother's young woman, and it kind of centered around a photograph. We're going to talk about photographs later. You have a whole chapter on photographs, but this is a photograph of her with some fairly famous writers. She was at a, I don't know, writer's retreat or something. She was a writer, as you mentioned. Tell me about this, and kind of centering on this photograph. You're kind of reproducing the drama in this photograph.
Well, this is another challenging one, and I want, as all of my essays are not quite as traumatic as this one. I mean, I have a lot of humor, but this is a rather sad event. But I think of all the essays I've written over the years, this one it is maybe one of my strongest. Because I wrote it kind of in the moment, this story about this photograph, when I we were going through all of these difficulties with her moving to, assisted living. But this photograph was from the famous writer's retreat called Yaddo in upstate New York. And this was 1950. She was a young writer, and she was surrounded by all these famous writers like William Carlos Williams, Theodore Rothke, just a bunch of really famous writers. And she told me about I didn't even know about this photo until, much later, when we just kind of ran across it in one of these boxes, and she told me all about it. But she had also told me in the photo, well, in the photo it shows they call it the class photo of 1950, and it shows her in this group photo, and she's standing in the back, and she looks really kind of haunted and uncomfortable. And when I saw the photo, I knew why, because what had happened, again, that she just sort of told me, sort of blurted out one day, was that one of the writers in that photo had assaulted her. And it was, it was at a time when it was difficult. Was it difficult for her and difficult for women in general to press charges or do anything like that? And at the time, so she just kind of buried the trauma of this until it came out. excuse me, years later. And so this essay in particular is about our own sort of personal histories. And how, even if we don't talk about them, sometimes they still sort of run on this loop, this obsessive loop in our memories, in our minds. I start with an epigraph by the poet Audre Lorde, which is a, excuse me, a famous quote of hers, "Your silence will not protect you." And that's really sort of what the essay is about, how it's, you have the right to whatever privacy you want, of course, but that doesn't mean that the effects of something that you're keeping secret aren't working on you, still, internally. So this essay was in part about our relationship and my inability to really, I mean, I completely sympathized and was shocked by what she told me, but she was, on the one hand, really, she wanted to tell me, and on the other hand, she was also very protective of it. So it was a very difficult kind of negotiation. And the essay itself, the form, is very circular. It keeps going back to certain things. And certain scenes, and keeps playing them over, over and over again. And at one point in the essay, so I had some relatively famous relatives, including Mo of the Three Stooges, and who is a cousin by marriage. And at one point in the essay, she kept a journal from the time she was 16, and she took out this journal and wanted me to read it to her, this part about Mo and his wife Helen, and about how she visited them when she was healthy and they were declining in health. And it was such a poignant, again, a kind of poignant moment for me, because the things she was saying about them in this old journal entry were what I was feeling about her at that moment, and which, likely perhaps my daughters will feel about me sometime in the future,
Yeah, that's circularity, right? The cycle. Yeah.
Yeah.
You write in that essay, it really struck me. And I think you were just talking about this. You say sometimes we say that history gets written by the victors, but sometimes history doesn't get written at all. Right.
Yeah.
But as you say with that epigraph, it still won't protect you. Still will resonate.
Right. I mean, there's so much that gets lost, and that's for so many reasons, because certain people have the, have much more of a platform for talking about history than others, on the one hand, and then also because so many people like my mother keep their own personal histories locked away. Whenever I, and she was a writer and she wrote these very thinly veiled autobiographical stories. I mean, I recognized myself in a lot of those stories, and she barely changed names. And yet, if you asked her about the past, she would say it's too painful, But she was still writing about it. And I always found that really interesting how she just needed that label of fiction, say it was a short story, to protect her. But yeah, a lot of history doesn't get written. And but it also sometimes exerts this kind of volcanic pressure upon society, and things that were once hidden get recorded by, people who maybe didn't have a platform before. Certainly that was in my childhood. The things I was taught about history were one version, but there's other versions too, that I also learned later. I mean, if you th you know, the larger histories, say even like the story of something large, like the story of the Little Bighorn and General Custer. The way it was taught when I was a kid is very different from the way, when I visited that monument, that battlefield, and the way it's taught in a much larger context now,
Let's take a break. We'll come back with more with Robin Hemley. His latest book is How to Change History, and it's out from University of Nebraska Press. We'll have to talk more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Robin Hemley. His latest book is How to Change History. It's a memoir of sorts, fragmented memoir in essays. Robin Hemley is with us for the hour. So Robin Hemley, I want to turn to one of my favorite chapters. This is a little lighter chapter. You talk about going to an Air Supply concert. I want to just read this. I think it's so good. Here's Robin Hemley. So you say your wife, she wants to go to a Air Supply concert at a casino, I think. So you say, I seize this as an opportunity after 12 years of marriage, akin to a renewal of vows, as close to sacrificing my life for as I'm going to get. It's a get-out-of-jail-free card, the one I will hold in reserve. Yes, I cheated on you with your best friend, but don't forget I went to see Air Supply live with you at Diamond Joe Casino in Dubuque. Hard work, marriage. And then you say, you remember Air Supply, what they sang. Of course you do. That song? And the one that sounded just like it, and the other one too. Yeah, those. So, by the way, I've been to an Air Supply concert. This was much earlier in their career.
Oh, really?
I love their songs. The songs all kind of sound alike. You're right there. So tell me a bit about this experience.
Sure. My wife, who is originally from the Philippines, she grew up with listening to Air Supply and a lot of 1970s romantic songs from the US, but she loved Air Supply. And so one day she said she was going to go with her friends, her Filipino friends, to an Air Supply concert. And she asked me if I wanted to come. And I just said, sure, I'll do it. I'll go, even though I've never liked Air Supply. And we drove from Iowa City to Dubuque, and went to this casino, and the concert hall, if you could call it that, was not very big at all. It was like as big as a a Waffle House maybe. And the rest, the casino itself completely dominated the place. And the concert was pretty, I mean, but I didn't love the songs, let's just say. But and all the songs sounded so much alike to me. At one point, I turned to Margie and said, what's the name of this song? And she said, oh, it's this. I can't remember the title. She says this. And I said, didn't they already play that? And then she just kind of waved me away. And I was such a pest. But she is very different from the way she was waving at the stage and was trying to sort of get the attention of the singers, who were, I thought, pretty funny themselves. I mean, one took the concert very seriously, and the as though he were performing in front of thousands, and the other, it was like his millionth time doing this, and he was very ironic and even a little snarky, and they couldn't even remember the name of the state they were in. One of them said, when I'm feeling, when I'm feeling like I want to write a song, I go to my little retreat, and I start writing. And if nothing comes, I'll just have a bottle of wine, and then something comes. And he was just a very sort of, I don't know, just he was very flip about everything, and it was kind of funny. So the whole thing was, it was a little more fun than I thought it would be. And at the end, Margie wanted to buy one of their t-shirts, which of course were super overpriced, like $45 for an Air Supply t-shirt, but it came with one of their CDs, which included some new music on it. I sort of mused that the songs, the new music, had as much a chance of becoming hits as, say, Farmer in the Dell. They were it was, not going to be something that most people, except for the diehard fans, would like. So I went out into the casino and I just decided, well, I'll play the nickel slots. And I put in a nickel, or and after about three times, all of a sudden, just all this money started pouring out. And I won something like 300 something dollars, which was more than enough for our tickets, for the drive, for the t-shirt, for all of that. And I just thought, well, kind of karma. I guess in this case, I was paid back for my for suffering through Air Supply.
Well, you're a good husband. That's, as you say, marriage is hard sometimes, but that's you did a solid there. I want to talk about an essay called Jim's Corner, which you say you don't, you're not wild about memorials, plaques. In this case, it's about a plaque, right?
Yes.
So this gentleman that, I mean, you hardly knew. You'd had maybe 10 conversations with him.
Yeah.
And they put up a plaque to him. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, yeah. His name was Jim Hedges, and this was when I was a young assistant professor at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. And he was this affable guy, middle-aged guy, and this was, in the early 90s, who was would stand sort of by the copying room in the English department in the hall and smoke cigarettes at a time when you could smoke indoors, and just collar anyone who walked by and just chat with them. And he did this a few times and with me. And as I said, he was nice, but often I was in a hurry on my way to classes, and I didn't always, give him as much of the time of day as I should have. And he would call me, he called me a young Turk, which is something that I don't even think that people use these days. But he was a nice guy. And then one day I came into the office and the secretary looked really stricken, and she said, "Did you hear? Jim Hedges died last night, of a heart attack. And I was really shocked and saddened by that. And then a little while later, maybe a couple months later, the department put up a plaque to him in the place where he used to stand and collar people. And they called it Jim's Corner. And I thought, okay, well, there's no context there, but at least, the people who go by this place know who he was and what it's referring to. And then, in the course of things, I moved away, got another job elsewhere across the country, and then, forgot about it. And then a couple of years later, I was invited back for a reading. And in the meantime, the English department had moved to a new building. And I asked my friend, a good friend of mine, what happened to Jim's Corner? And he said, "Well, I knew you were going to ask me about that. I don't know what happened to it, except that the plaque was taken down. It's now criminal justice, and they probably threw it away or sent it to, his widow, his family." And it made me just think about how it made me really think about memorial plaques and things like that, the way we pretend sometimes that any kind of commemoration is permanent when it's not. There are like those park benches you'll come to where it says, in memory of so and so who, used to watch the sunset here. And they're poignant. They're nice. But at the same time, when someone sees one of them who doesn't have any connection to that person, they tend to sort of glide right over that and don't really think about it. So it doesn't actually help us remember anyone. There was one of the plaques that I mentioned in the essay that really struck me was one that was in such an inconvenient spot in the Cincinnati airport. It was this plaque between moving sidewalks, and it was on the wall between the moving sidewalks, and it was commemorating some person who had worked there for 12 years and had passed away. And I thought, this spot, you could not choose a spot more perfect for people to just ignore it than this one. Because who's going to sort of stop in the middle of their, catching a plane and going from one moving sidewalk to another and then say, "Hey, I'm going to read this plaque." Well, I did. But that's just because I have this obsession with them. But yeah, so I'm really, it's not that I don't like plaques. I do in some ways, but I just wish they actually did their job of commemorating. I wish that there was a way that people could be people who aren't necessarily famous, who could be remembered. But when eventually, they become sort of places where people don't even, recognize them as memorials. They're just like little smudges on a park bench or on a wall.
I think part of this impulse is, to be remembered, and your impulse to you wanted to make sure Jim was remembered, even though you didn't know him that well, right?
Yeah.
I guess it's our own mortality, right? So when is the last time Jim's going to get remembered? We're talking about him right now. It's in your book, right? But when's the last
Yeah.
time you'll be remembered? When's the last time I'll be remembered, right? Judy Garland is there, forever in quotes,
Right,
right? But
right.
it's kind of an altered memory.
Well, it's like I guess I kind of like to do my part to remember Jim. I mean, it's a kind of a stubbornness, I guess, that yeah, it's not going to be forever, but I'll do my part. And in the essay, I even say at the end, this essay is Jim's Corner. It's his plaque for a while at least, Yeah, so I think that but even someone like Judy Garland, even the people we might remember really well, I teach college students, and they, if I asked in my class of 20 how many people know who Judy Garland is, I mean, you'd probably be shocked, how few recognize her. I mean, I wouldn't be all that surprised if no one raised their hand.
Yeah. So even she's kind of disappearing over time.
Well, yeah, I mean these films of hers are in some ways memorials too. And when you and I have this kind of odd obsession, I guess, of re wanting to read authors who have been forgotten, you know, to go back in the past and read authors or to listen to music that's been forgotten. I mentioned in that prologue a star of the 1920s, Annette Hanshaw. And she was like as big a star as, you know, Judy Garland in the nine, I mean, or as Beyonce in the 1920s. Everyone in America knew who she was. Now, I would be surprised if anyone knew who she was. But she, I found a record of hers when I was a college student. And I really, it was this kind of silly song. It was called True Blue Lou. And I had this old Victrola and I'd play it and some other records. And I just thought, you know, at its time in the 1920s, when everyone knew who Annette Hanshaw was, people did all the things to this music that they do now to current music. They proposed, they kissed, they ate meals, they whatever, you know, but it was part of the fabric of their lives. And you know, now it's not. And so I have this urge sometimes to go back and, let's say, resurrect these forgotten people. In one of my essays, I found a scrapbook from the 1940s, this fascinating scrapbook of a woman named Mary Hilliard, who I don't know anything about other than this scrapbook from 1941 to 45. And it has a bunch of stuff like in it that's kind of wild, like dental x-rays, her birth certificate, the silk stocking she wore through World War II, and restaurant menus, theater flyers, all kinds of things. And they're amazing in some ways, but there's no context to this sort of self memorial. But I bought this at a yards not a yard sale, an estate sale in Virginia for a pretty high price, for $75. And I love it because, to me, even though I don't know who Mary Hilliard was, I have this little treasure of her life, of things that she thought were important during these 4 years.
I just have 5 or 6 minutes left in the conversation. It's flown by. I wanted to get in the little discussion of this your chapter on photographs. A lot here. I guess the thing that most struck me in this chapter was your discussion of, and I'm not familiar with Roland Barthes, his Camera Lucida. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, that's yeah.
So he talks about a photo, but he refuses to put the photo in the book. Tell me about this. But you said in the end, it's indelible on you because of his description.
Yeah. So it's a photo of his mother, and I love this. I mean, this book, Camera Lucida, was written shortly before he died. It was his last book, and it's a book on photography, but I really think it's a book that is a memorial to his mother that's disguised as a book on photography. He discusses he's really one of the most interesting theorists on photography, but he reproduces all these old photographs, the Queen Victoria, you know, the first photograph ever done as well, and all these photographs, and he writes about them. But there's one photograph, the photograph of his mother and his uncle, taken when they were both children in the early 1900s in a kind of what's called a winter garden, a glass conservatory with plants. And it was taken shortly before their parents divorced. And it's this really sweet photograph, apparently, of the two of them holding hands near a bridge. And he describes the photo beautifully and talks about the context and says that the reason why he loves this photograph is because his mother has this sort of half smile in the photograph that she had for most of her life. And he was looking for photographs of her that he wanted a photograph that best captured who she was in life. She had died recently and he was mourning her. So he found this photograph and felt it was really, 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 it really captured her. But he wouldn't put the photograph in the book because he said it was private, it was his, and that whatever the reader would get from it was not what he wanted. You know, it was something for him, but he still wrote about it. And when I think about that book, Camera Lucida, that is what immediately leaps to mind. I almost can't remember many of the other photos in the book, but this one, because it had so much emotion behind it, and because he was so intent on memorializing his mother in this way, that was both more than a photograph and, you know, and very private at the same time. You know, he did such a good job of that, and it makes me, you know, it had a greater impact on me as a reader.
Just a couple of minutes left. I want to just end with this. Also on photographs, you say you love studying photographs. Could be whatever photographs from your family or whatever. And you say they're really for a portrait. It's they're not candid, right? There's you. Everybody is acting to some degree.
Right. Yeah, true. I mean, I see a photograph as, I mean, there's so many different kinds, but you know, say the author's photo, like my mother's author's photos, you know, it's a projection of who she wanted to be, you know, the famous author. And it's this very stylized photo taken in the 1940s. And just so many photos are about performance, even ones that we think are accurate. Like I mentioned the Civil War photos of Matthew Brady and how, you know, he would arrive at a Civil War battle scene days after the battle took place. And so he would pose his assistants on the battlefield to play corpses. And it wasn't because he was trying to trick anyone. It was because he wanted to give a sense of what the battle was like. And so I'm really interested in those photos that are almost how they're, I guess they're kind of manipulated, and they do sort of are they're put out there as a kind of performance. I live very close to one of these photo booths, which have become very popular again. And it has a line way out the door, and there's four photos for $8. And everyone loves to be in this, you know, photo booth and get and try their best to make this kind of performance out of the photograph booth. I find it really interesting.
Well, much else we could say about the book. We're out of time. We've been talking with the writer Robin Hemley. Latest book is called How to Change History. It's out and available from University of Nebraska Press. A fascinating book, well worth the read. Robin Hemley, thanks so much. Appreciate the hour.
Oh, thank you. It's really delightful. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah today.